The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour, and they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll, and it's 4th of July weekend. So happy 4th to all of you American listeners. And what better way to kick it off than a good old American Duff McKagan joke of the week?
Chris Jericho. Steph McKagan calling you. I'm actually calling you during your big fancy TV show, you know, but I just really couldn't wait. You know, my wife asked me, you know, what I do here at home in case of a, you know, what steps I take in case there's a fire here at home. Really big ones apparently wasn't the right answer. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
All right. A little bit of a groaner there, but thanks to Duff for getting our weekend started with a laugh. He's going to be hanging out at home this weekend. No touring with Guns N' Roses because of the Rona. But there's a couple of silver linings from this crazy pandemic, like quarantine, for one. That's quarantine with a K. If not for the coronavirus, you wouldn't have a non-makeup era Kiss cover band featuring myself and Bruce Kulick. And that means you wouldn't have this killer cover of Heart of Chrome. I'm going to play it for you right here, right now.
Yeah.
New single from Quarantine. That's our version of Heart of Chrome with the amazing Bruce Kulick on guitar. It's out now. You can see the video on YouTube. And you can get Heart of Chrome and No, 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 the first song we did, which is number 60 on the mainstream rock charts. I sent that to Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley, that No, No, No is charting in an American rock and roll, a radio chart in 2020. It's pretty damn cool. So you can get all of those tunes, both those tunes on iTunes, Amazon, Spotify, wherever you get your rock and roll music. So, all right, thank you so much. If you're staying at home this weekend as well, because you live in an area that's back in lockdown because the virus is spiking and surging, then come hang with me tomorrow night for the Saturday night special. We'll celebrate the 4th with some drinks, a little Q&A, that's E-H for A, and of course the sing-along. So get your questions and song requests together and join me on Facebook Live or on my official YouTube channel tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Eastern. Right now, though, we're going to get into a little true crime with Billy Jensen, true crime journalist, author, and host of the Murder Squad podcast. He's going to share some of the crimes he's helped solve over the last 20 years, how he was able to do it. He's also talking about the new HBO documentary series, I'll Be Gone in the Dark, about a little-known serial killer called the Golden State Killer, who I believe was just charged this past week. Billy was involved in that documentary because he helped write the book that the doc is based on. It's a bone-chilling, crazy story. You'll hear all about that in the incredible case of the Golden State Killer. Michelle McNamara was the true crime writer who was investigating and writing about the Golden State Killer case. She actually coined the name, but she passed away before finishing I'll Be Gone in the Dark. So Billy stepped in, a close friend, to finish the book and help with the documentary, which just started airing on HBO this week. So let's get to the true crime stories from journalist Billy Jensen. Hear about some of the fascinating cases that he's helped to solve. It's True Crime, Talk is Jericho, right here, starting now. So one of the, of course, you guys know, something we love to talk about here on Talk is Jericho is the true crime element and all of the kind of crazy stories that surround that. But as long, it seems like it was years ago, but at the start of kind of the COVID era, there's a couple of great shows on Netflix. One of them, of course, that everyone was talking about was Tiger King. Another one was Don't F with Cats. And that kind of kicked off the idea to have Billy Jensen on, who is an investigative journalist, and who also you've gone far and above beyond just being a journalist and kind of actually started to try and solve some of these crimes on your own.
Yeah, no, I've solved or helped solve 10 murders using social media and finding missing persons. And that's sort of what I've become. I've become kind of like a consulting detective for not only victims' families, or consulting digital detective for victims' families and also police departments. When they get stuck, they call me.
Which is interesting, because if you look back kind of like in the 70s or whatever, they would go for the psychics and that sort of thing. But now the modern day psychic is kind of, like you said, the guys who know how to kind of run and go through and comb the internet for clues and all these sort of things. So tell us, how did you start getting into this, and how did you solve 10 separate murders? Like, tell us about the first one that you solved that got you into this.
Yeah, so, you know, my friend was writing a book. You know, I've been writing about unsolved murders for 20 years, and the thing about writing about unsolved murders is that you're writing stories with no endings, and you'd always try to solve them, and you'd always try to push the case forward, but, you know, you had no endings. And my friend of mine was writing a book about the Golden State Killer, and she passed away in the middle of writing it. And right after she passed away, I just got really, I would always say, whenever anybody asked me why I did this, I would say, I hate the guy that got away with it. That's why I do this. But I also just, you know, after she died, something just really triggered me. And I was up late one night. I saw this video of this man being attacked in a street in Chicago. And he, there was video from a 7-Eleven, and the guy is confronted. He tries to walk away. This bigger guy starts chasing after him. And then the guy turns around right in front of the street, and the guy clocks him, the bigger guy. And he falls into the street completely out cold. Then a bunch of people, as they're going to do, they gather around him. This big guy looked like he was probably 6'3", 250. Walks back and yells at everybody. You can't see it. You're just watching this from a traffic camera now, but you can tell that he's yelling at them because everybody disperses. And he's laying there in a crosswalk. 2 minutes later, a cab, not knowing he was there, runs over his chest and kills him.
Oh, wow.
And I'm watching this video, and there was really clear video of this perp. And I was just like, well, why you know, it was 2 months later when I'm watching the video, I'm saying, why don't they know who this guy is? How can they not figure this guy out? And I'm looking at his family, and his family was doing a press conference, and like, they still didn't know who this was. And then something clicked, and I said, I know why, because nobody's watching the news. Nobody's watching, you know, news is so fragmented now. Initially, 50 years ago, it would be on three television stations and it'd be in the newspaper, which everybody right. would read. Now they don't. And I said, well, you know what? I think I can do this with social media. And I reached out to a bunch of people, and I created a Facebook page called the River North Puncher with his images, created a Twitter, sent the tweet out, and then begged everybody in Chicago, because what I was thinking was like, this had gotten national news, but it wasn't, I didn't care about any, I just cared about the 1 square mile around there. Somebody would be able to recognize this guy. And sure enough, you know, I posted the video. I got a retweet from a guy named Barstool Big Cat, which was great, from the Barstool sports team. And then right. 2 days later, I got somebody retweeted back to us or replied to us and said, I hope this helps. And it was a front-facing picture of the perp. And I was amazed. And I thought maybe this guy had done some sort of computer imaging to make it look like, you know, he just took the picture from up high and black and white and then made it color. And I was just like, well, where'd you get this? And he wouldn't. And I was like, please DM me. Finally DM. And he said, actually, my friend took it and he was there and he sent me a video. And the video is the most chilling thing I've ever seen. It starts with the victim, Marcus Gaines, on the ground in the crosswalk, the last image you'll ever see of him. And then it swings up, and then the puncher is walking right towards me. And
oh my gosh.
And I said, wow, this guy was there. And I was asking him, like, did you hear anything? Did he have an accent? Do you have this or that? But now I had a front-facing picture. And Cook County actually puts all of their mugshots online. So I just went through, and the guy had a very distinctive widow's peak, like a Dracula kind of thing. He was a big, tall, black guy, had a widow's peak, and his victim was a bartender who was also black. And just with everything I was reading about this guy, he just seemed like the most, just a great guy, great dancer, impeccable dresser, was a bartender. Everybody loved him. Not a bad thing to say about this guy. And I go through, and then I find three guys that could be it. And it was almost like Goldilocks. It was like one could have been too old, one was too short, one was too tall. Because I couldn't quite see it at the time how tall this guy was. But I thought this guy was the guy. His guy's name is Marcus Moore. I got his photograph, and I actually went to Chicago and then toured the streets. Third guy I saw said, yeah, we call him Big Dummy. His real name is Marcus. And then from there, I put together a dossier, gave it to the police department, and the police didn't do anything. So then it was a matter of me having to go constantly contact the police department saying, I know where he is, because now that I had his name, I had his Facebook page and I was able to track him via Facebook. And he was saying that he was in Holbrook, New York, but I knew he wasn't in Holbrook, New York, because he had taken a picture or somebody had taken a picture of him, and there was a City Works truck in the back and it had a logo. I identified the logo, and the logo was a Minneapolis Works truck, or a Twin Cities Works truck. So I said, he's in Minnesota, because I know that because his brother's in Minnesota. And then he just said, you know, he could do the relationship status on Facebook. He got in a relationship with a woman from Minnesota. So I had his address from where his brother, I was like, he's there. Finally, after begging and pleading about 4 months later, the marshals went in and got him. So that was the first one. And, you know, it's been a lot of, you know, some successes, a lot of failures, but it works, and it's just a matter of targeting people in that area. Now what I do is I create geo-targeted advertising where I will get a image of a crime that the cops are just like, they're baffled with. They have an image of the person or a sketch and they don't know who it is, and I will buy targeted advertising in that 1 mile radius of where the crime happened. And then people will contact me, and then I funnel it over to the police.
I mean, once you kind of solve one of those things, then you probably have a little bit of steam to where they're going to believe you more and listen to you more.
That's exactly right. And that's the whole reason why I wrote the book, too. It was a matter of, let's teach everybody to fish. And it was, you know, I was doing this with my own money. I was like, I've spent like $25,000 with my own money just doing it, because these ads cost money.
Right.
So as I was, you know, searching for this or that, and then there were some that, like, I just thought, there was one guy that killed a woman in New York the video was so clear, and it was in Owl's Head Park, Brooklyn, and the video was so clear of this guy walking down the street. I thought, I'm going to get this guy in a week, and I've spent probably like $3,500, and I still haven't gotten him. Gotten so many tips, so many leads, been working with the cops with that one, and it's just, you know, it's a constant sort of struggle in order to try and find these guys, especially in a place like New York too, which is so dense. But when you get a place that's a little bit smaller, you have people just willing to help and willing to reach out, because I'm not a cop, and they're willing to just talk to me over Facebook as opposed to like calling up a number, you know, for Crime Stoppers or something.
It's interesting too, because even in the state of the world right now with all of the unrest that's going on the streets of America was caused by, you know, basically a cell phone video capturing this horrendous murder. So it would seem that as a criminal, it's harder and harder to get away without being filmed. But what you're saying is, even if you get a capture of a guy's face, it still doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to be easy to find.
Yeah, no, he's not. And, you know, if this was, we do have a lot more people, you know, obviously when a cop is killing somebody, which is what they did when these four cops murdered this man, George Floyd, he was, you know, the cops were there and they can, you know, they was on, you know, most murders don't take that long. You know, 8 minutes, right? they were on this guy. And that's enough time to get out a cell phone. But a lot of, you know, and cell phones are really good to record stuff with because the cameras are amazing. But a lot of times you're also dealing with cameras that are from up high and they're grainy and there's just a lot of things that make it harder. But there's still always one clue in there. You know, I was able to identify a guy that was wearing a Halloween mask. And, you know, just there's always like you can look at, let's look at his shoes. Let's look at the way he moves. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to just be a face.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, the book is Chase Darkness with Me, which is a great title and lots of interesting tidbits and stuff. I started this to talk about Luca Magnotti, but we can get to that in a bit. You mentioned the Halloween mask murderer. Tell me that story.
Yeah, this guy was working on his day off at a Jack in the Box, and I saw this video of this guy, another guy, comes into the Jack in the Box, kind of leaps over the counter where the registers are. You see him pull out a gun, then you see him leap back out. In the interim, you didn't see the murder on camera, but he shot this victim. And his name was Juan Vidal, looked like a great guy. You know, he's a big like Smiths and Morrissey fan, Latino guy and in LA. And I saw that and I was like, well, is there anything I can do with this? And it had been a few months and I said, well, let me just try it. And, you know, I was asking people and I would go to places like Reddit and say, does anybody recognize these shoes, these sneakers? But they were so... It was so pixelated that actually on Reddit, because Reddit has a lot of jokesters, somebody wrote like, yeah, those are the pixel 12s or something, which was funny. But right. Because you get a lot of people like trying to make jokes. But, it, you know, if a joke is going to be funny, at least, you know, it'll boost the algorithm.
Exactly.
Yeah. But, you know, it was just a matter of just putting it out there and triangulating, because I had learned later that he had done another crime with a similar MO. So first I was like trying to identify the Halloween mask. And then I was looking at the way this guy was moving. He jumped over the counter so quickly and so swiftly. I was like, this is not an older guy, not even like a 25-year-old, you know, unless they're in really, really good shape. I was like, this is going to be a younger guy. And, you know, being able to target the ads to people that might know this person, you know, to younger people. And that's what happened is that, you know, somebody saw it and saw the car, you know, the car that they were driving in, the getaway car. They had seen that as well. And then they were able to pick him up. And then I think 2 days later, they picked up the guy that was driving the getaway car.
And that's all. How long did it take for you to figure that one out?
That was probably 3 months, I think. It took a while. Yeah.
So how does this come to your attention? Because, I mean, there's murders every single day. Which are the ones that kind of spark your interest to think I can do something with this?
Yeah, I mean, I always, with those two, I always, you know, if I see it and if I see a clear piece of video, you know, I have Google alerts and everything for it. So there's three ways that come about. One, it's me looking for them because people still don't know. Most people don't know who the hell I am. So they'll see it. I'll see a piece of video and I'll say, that's pretty, you know, they should be able to find that guy. And I put it in a folder and I wait 2 weeks. Most of the time they find him. If it's after 2 weeks, I'm like, you know what? Let me call up the police and explain what I do. and then say, hey, what do you want? Now, sometimes the police say, no, we know who it is. We just haven't made an arrest yet. Chill out. And I'm like, yep, chilling out. It's okay. Sometimes they say yes. Sometimes police will have heard of me and will contact me and say, hey, we heard you did this for this department. Can you do it for us? And then sometimes it's victims, families, you know. In general, it's always going to be better with video because video does so good on social media. A sketch is okay. When you get into cars, I mean, I've been able to identify a car that there's only 300 of them in registered in LA County, which they should be able to narrow down, which, you know, an owner and take it to, you know, I'm not quite sure how the whole cars thing works. I have not had luck like just identifying someone just strictly from a car, but, you know, if a family member calls me up and asks me, hey, could you try? I'm still going to try.
Some of these stories end on more of a positive note. You said that you found a girl missing in the California Redwoods, which is a huge forest. I'm sure not an easy task. How did you manage to do that?
That one was such a heartbreaking story for this mother. I had worked on the case of Danielle Bertolini, who went missing in Northern California. And then a year later, her skull was found. And I was talking, you know, then I'm on Facebook and I get a message from a friend of her mother saying her other daughter is missing. I was like, oh my God, what else does this woman have to go through? So I contact the mom. I'm like, okay, let's figure this out. I'll put an ad out, but this is a missing persons thing. I've never done a missing persons thing before. While we're talking, she's like, I think this might be like, she had a phone number of somebody she might be with. And, you know, yes, there was a history of drug use and things. I'm thinking, like, if she's with a guy, I can't just call him up. He's going to hang up on me and then block my number. So I start texting him. And I text him just things like, hey, things that either a girl would say or somebody that was looking for drugs would say.
Right.
So, yeah, you know what I mean? Just sort of like, so he's always going to be like, who's this? So I get him on the hook. So he knows that if I call, he's going to pick up. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I started to coordinate with the mom and then I called him up and I said, listen, where, you know, we know who you are. Like, where is she? And he said, and then finally I was able to get her on the phone. I was like, listen, you know, you don't want to do this, you know? And she said, okay. And she went straight to the, we matched her up with a police officer down there and were able to do that. And now she went to rehab and everything. And then she had a baby and that's the one of the good feel-good stories there. Because I was telling her, too. I was like, listen, I need you to help solve your sister's murder because I'm still on that. Mm-hmm. And I need your help with that. You know, if you don't want to, obviously, there's, you know, the opioid epidemic is huge, too. 70,000 people die every year. It's just like, if you don't want to stick around for that, stick around for yourself, stick around for your sister, you know.
So she was going to kind of run away.
We don't know, you know. I didn't get into it, you know. I wasn't going to, you know.
Point being, she wasn't at home.
Somebody might have taken her, you know, who this dude was and everything, but yeah.
So, yeah, well, that's, that, man, and did you ever solve the murder of her sister?
I think I know who did it, or at least the two guys that did it, and this is just one of those deals where they just don't have enough evidence, but I'm just staying on it. I talk with the family members all the time, and it's more than one murder up there. And this is in the, you know, what they call the Emerald Triangle up there in Northern California.
Is that frustrating for you when you pretty much know who it is, but you can't get the right evidence to bust them?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that's one of the things that people have to realize when you're looking at law enforcement is that a lot of times they have to have so much evidence that they're going to convince 12 strangers that this person killed another person. So you need to have, and you can't just go in and just say, oh, we tried and then try again because there's double jeopardy law. So it's a big, big process to do that. And you have to have so many ducks in a row. And there's a lot of criminals that are out there that they know the cops have a pretty good idea or are, 99% sure, but they just can't do anything because the DA won't, you know, the DA knows that like there might be one juror in there that could throw a wrench in, and they're just saying, just get me this one last, that last thing, this one piece of evidence. Sure, you can roll the dice, and there are some DAs that will be, you know, there's sometimes a cop will go to a DA and say, hey, listen, this is all we can get. We can get this guy. Some DAs that are a little bit more confident will say, yeah, let's do it. Some are a little bit more cautious and say, listen, we still need more.
Just kind of going through some of the highlights of the book that are really kind of interesting stories. before we kind of latch onto some of the longer ones. You said that you investigated the only other murder in New York City on 9/11.
Yes.
And the other, and when you say the only other murder, the other murder is the 3,500 people that died in the towers, sort of
yes,
thing.
Yes, of course, yeah. And gotcha. No, the murder was of a Polish immigrant named Henryk Siwiak, and he had actually gone looking for work in Manhattan that morning. And while the towers were going down, he was still knocking on doors. I mean, this guy was desperate for work, and he eventually got a job through an ad cleaning supermarkets in Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn. And he got off at the wrong stop. It was at night. He was wearing kind of like army surplus clothes, and he had a backpack, and he didn't know where he was. He was knocking on doors. He was looking for a supermarket. He was on the complete other end of the street, and somebody shot him. Nobody talked about it, you know, and it was never solved. The police actually got there pretty quickly, but, you know, that was the first unsolved case that I ever did. And I remember going there to Bed-Stuy and knocking on doors and talking to people and getting information that even the police didn't. I felt like I was pushing the investigation forward, talking to, you know, I was just like, you live three doors down. Did the police ever contact you? No. What did you hear? And then had the number of shots. And I heard it, you know, could be this or this. But they never, it was just one of those deals where the police never got there. And it's, you know, if they ever find that gun, I remember them saying it was an odd caliber gun. If they ever find that gun, maybe that's the only way that they would ever be able to match it up, or if somebody ever confesses.
So that was never solved then?
No, that one was never solved, no.
Talk about bad timing, you know, or good timing, depending on how you want to look at it, of a murder that happens on 9/11.
Yeah, you know, I think it's, when you think about it, it actually got me thinking of other crimes that were committed during acts like this, you know, during big moments in history, and what else sort of got, you know, unsolved or solved that got, you know, swept under the rug or nobody would hear about it, you know, during the DC sniper case, which was all over Maryland and in Virginia, there was a woman who was fighting with drug dealers, and the drug dealers burned her house down and killed her whole family. And it was like those kind of cases that are out there, you know, and there's going to be some, I'm sure, that have happened right now with the unrest that we've just seen and the protests, which the protests were rightfully so, and they should continue going. You know, you're going to see some crimes that are going to be not get the attention that they deserve because the headlines are being dominated by other stuff.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
So let's talk a little more about your book and how you kind of took it over, or after another crime reporter passed away, were these some cases that she had been looking at, or did you get inspiration to try and do this kind of as a tribute to her?
No, that was just the inspiration. It was more of a being fed up. You know, it's just like we write these stories, and I know how long she was writing a story about the Golden State Killer. Her name is Michelle McNamara, and it was just a matter of, you know, not only the family and the victim's life, but also just people that have devoted like so much time in order to solve this mystery that this guy is keeping to himself and just taking other lives away. And, you know, she was so dedicated to this book, and that's why I was just like, and I've got to help finish this book. So I called up her husband, who's the comedian Patton Oswalt.
Oh,
and
wow. I said, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And I said, I'll do anything I can, you know, to help with this book. So myself and Patton and her researcher, Paul Haynes, we got together and we finished the book. It's called I'll Be Gone in the Dark. Yeah.
She didn't pass away due to any type of crime investigation.
No, she passed away in her sleep.
Gotcha. So let's go into it, because I know that according to the book that Michelle was pursuing the Golden State Killer. And you helped finish the book. Did you ever kind of find... First of all, tell us who the Golden State Killer is and the story behind that.
Yeah, the Golden State Killer, one of the worst serial killers that you never heard of. And
right.
Think about what this guy would do. Initially, he started with, with break-ins and peeping toms, and then he started raping women, and then he started getting off raping women with their husbands in the house. So he would come in with a gun, he would tie up the husband and put him on his back and put plates on his back, and then say, if I hear these plates move, I'm going to kill your wife, then come in here and kill you. And then he would take the woman into the other room and then rape her. And then he would just kind of like chill out in the house and eat and then take weird stuff and then leave. He eventually graduated to murder, and he murdered at least 13 people that we know of and raped at least 50 in similar manners like this. And this was in, first it was in the Sacramento area. Then the murders were around Sacramento, but then they would also drop down to the Ventura area in Orange County. So he had two names. They didn't know this was the same guy. He was killing people down there and killing people up there. His name in Sacramento was the East Area Rapist. His name down south near Los Angeles was the Original Night Stalker. And those are two just bad names, you know? I mean, you know, just being as, right. You know, it's like, I'm sure you've been, right. Being in wrestling, you know, like the names is like so often a big deal. And it's just like, these names, it's just like, east of what? East Area of what? You know, that's not going to get, and then Original Night Stalker, you mean there was another Night Stalker? And obviously they're talking about Richard Ramirez, but like, it's two awful names. And I said, well, you know, Michelle said, I want to rename this guy. And people were like, really? You know, and me was like, no, I don't, even before, you know, I knew her, I was like, I don't know why she would do this, but she named him the Golden State Killer. And because of her work, it stuck. She wrote an article in LA Magazine, and then she got a book deal from that. And, you know, people started calling him the Golden State Killer. When she passed away, he was still out there, but her death became international news because of who she was married to, because of Patton. And she was also an amazing writer, but because of Patton. So it was in People Magazine. It was in all these different places. It was international news. You know, 2 months later, they decide to, you know, add more reward money. They say, we're going to work more with the FBI, all of these things, and like reinvigorate the case. You know, a lot of that had to do with her, you know, her dying, and then people writing, yeah, there was a housewife that was trying to solve a case, and, you know, the police saying, well, maybe we should put more effort behind it and solve this case. So, you know, when I actually met Paul Holes, who's the guy who eventually solved the case, at Michelle's memorial, and he had been working on it forever. And it was just, you know, her memorial was just such a surreal scene. You know, I just lost a really good friend, and, you know, because of who she was friends with, people like, you're at a memorial for a friend, and like Weird Al is there, and Conan is there, right. And John Mulaney and Amy Mann and all these people. And, you know, I start talking to Paul, I gravitate towards Paul, and we start talking about cases. I start telling him about this case that I'm working on, which was Bear Brook, which is the Allenstown 4 case, which is four bodies found in barrels in Allenstown, New Hampshire, in 1985 and in 2000, a woman, three children, all unidentified, perp unidentified. And we start talking about DNA, and I was just like, yeah, we start talking about familial DNA, and I put that kind of in his head. And then we went off, and then he gave me thoughts about the case, and like we started a little bit of a rapport together. Turns out a few months later, he's on the phone with people who had figured out how to identify the killer of the woman and three children. And he learns about familial DNA and learns about this woman, Barbara Rae Venter, who's able to take the DNA from a crime scene, put it into a public database, and then see if you could find any relatives and then work a family tree down to try and find the perp. They do that together. They land on a guy named Joseph James DeAngelo, who was actually a former cop. And they were able to, you know, once they said, all right, this probably is the guy, they were able to get direct DNA from him, from a tissue. And they said, this is the guy right here. And turns out, you know, I couldn't believe it when that happened. And there's a big part in the book about that and just how surreal that moment was. It felt like a dream. And I remember just like not believing it and then doing searches that night. I was up all night and doing searches for who this guy was. And I found a newspaper.com article, an old archive that said, he was arrested and he just quit the force after shoplifting. I was just like, well, who just quits the police force after shoplifting? The cop unions usually, you know, will always defend everybody. And then it said he was shoplifting dog repellent and a hammer. And I said, oh, wow, this is the guy. This has to be the guy. And sure enough, you know, they had nailed him. And that's a subject of, on June 28th, HBO has a docuseries about Michelle and the book that I'm in called I'll Be Gone in the Dark. And it was just, you know, just an amazing sort of scenario about everything that, that was able to come into play. And then after that case, the floodgates opened and they've been able to solve, I think it's close to 100 murders now via genetic genealogy. So I will tell you this, everybody go get your like 23andMe or Ancestry.com, you know, spit in the tube when they send it back to you. It's really easy to go to someplace like GEDmatch, like an open source one, and upload your DNA in there. And you might actually solve a murder from a third cousin you would have never known before just by, you know, spitting in a tube and then making that extra effort.
That's incredible. I mean, what a story. Like you said, that's the most famous serial killer that no one's ever heard of before. Is this different from the Zodiac killer? Is it
different from the Zodiac, yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Man, that's crazy, putting plates on somebody's back.
I mean, think about how, what's the safest place? You're in your house with your spouse, you know, in a locked bedroom, you know, and not only that, he would break into the houses ahead of time. He would make friends with the dogs, like feed them and stuff. He would go into a couple times, he would get a pistol that the guy had and take the bullets out. He could have just stolen the gun, but he would take the bullets out. You know, it was this, this thing was, I mean, so many crimes, especially sex crimes, are all about control and power. I mean, this guy was the ultimate power tripper.
Wow. So, jeez. Yeah, hard to just move on to the next, but something that you brought up that I thought was very interesting when we were talking about topics to discuss. There's so much to talk about here and so many ways you could go, but this is like a mixed nut version of Billy Jensen's work. We got some walnuts here and we got some cashews there. But let's talk about the Tupac and Biggie case, because that's something you brought up to me and still very shady and no one really knows the story. So kind of give us the background and go through where that case is up at this point in time.
You know, those cases have stalled. And so has Jam Master Jay. I always like to put him in there,
too.
No
one knows anything about that one.
Three legends, all, you know, shot in public scenarios, you know.
Yeah.
If you've ever been to Los Angeles, that's a crowded intersection and with a bunch of people there where Biggie was shot. And a guy pulls up, you know, wearing a bow tie and shoots into his car. You know, Tupac had gotten into a fight with a guy, a gangster. I think probably Tupac, of the three, they know who it was. It was Orlando. It was this guy that he got into that beef with at the casino. And he had been subsequently shot after that and killed. So, you know, but he was shot on a side street right off of the strip. And then, you know, in a recording studio, you know, with Jam Master Jay. And it's just the amount when you think about legends, you know, these are three legends, and to not know who killed them is pretty insane. And for, you know, especially now as Black Lives Matter has become so huge, thankfully, you know, think about it. If there's older white listeners that can't imagine if we still didn't know who shot John Lennon, you know,
right.
Just like that. You know, these guys were just as influential, just as important to their listeners and to their community as John Lennon was.
Of course.
With all three of them, you know. And these are not just sort of guys on the outskirts, you know. And to think that nobody's ever gone to trial for those crimes is really insane, and it boggles the mind. So, you know, there have been, you know, the cases come up every now and again. There have been a lot of books written about it. But, you know, I think it's one of those things that you just got to keep on it. And you're hoping that somebody will either confess or, you know, I never say never in terms of a crime. You know, somebody will either confess to it. Somebody will wear a wire and catch somebody. But those cases just have always boggled my mind because of how important those guys were. And it's not just like, oh, they were important now because they died and then they became martyrs. No, these guys were huge in their field, you know.
Well, especially Jam Master Jay. Like, I had DMC on this podcast and they don't even know.
Yeah.
Like, that's just a total assassination that comes out of nowhere.
Yeah. And it could, you know, Jam Master Jay was the one that figured out, let's rap over Walk This Way. You know, which was the entry point for hip hop to go into suburban white culture. You know, this everything that has happened sprouted out of that moment in terms of being amplified that much. I mean, there were a lot of people before Run DMC, but you know what? It was like white America was not, you know, they were still in their bubble listening to, you know, Soft Cell or whatever the hell they were listening to in the early 80s. And, right. You know, that talent was able to stretch it out and say, all right, this is here to stay. And now it's the most dominant art form right now in America. And I think it's like, you know, to think about somebody that was that influential and having them. Yeah, I think a lot of it is a race issue as well, you know. Right. It's just a matter of, you know, there's a guy named Jesse Belvins who was murdered after a gig down south, and he was supposed to be like the next Sam Cooke. And then Sam Cooke was murdered too. It's just like, yeah, it just happens over and over and over again. And yeah, the resources were not applied in the same way that they would have. Now, granted, yeah, John Lennon's killer stayed there, you know. John Lennon's killer shot him, you know, and then just, you know, sat down and read a book. But, you know, a lot more could have been done with those other investigations.
Yeah. And it's always one of those things too, where it's like, you know, Lennon's was a stalker, and who knows what kind of dealings were going on with Tupac and Biggie's, you know, the known kind of, not mob guys, but there's a whole, you know, syndicate in that world, in the rap world, that maybe something went down. But Jam Master Jay was like a preacher. Like, what the hell did he ever do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And then, like, you know, you know, there was all the beef about, oh, Tupac and Biggie and the relationships and diss tracks. So it was like, you know what? You know who did diss tracks before that? Lennon and McCartney did diss tracks. You know, look, go listen to How Do You Sleep. That's great all point. About McCartney, you know? I mean, those are diss tracks.
Great point. Okay, let's get back on to where we started the show, which was, you know, we mentioned everyone was talking about Tiger King, and a friend of mine said, well, you should watch Don't F*** with Cats. And I was like, okay, is this another cat show? I had enough cats. And it's like, no, it's got nothing to do with cats. So to watch that, if you haven't seen it, it's also on Netflix. And it's funny because I'm from Canada, and I wasn't living there at the time, but I remember something about this Luca Magnotta. It's a very easy name to remember. And this story is just crazy, especially how it unfolds.
Yes.
Why don't you kind of go into it, the whole saga of what this guy was all about?
Sure. Yeah, so I wrote a story about this for Rolling Stone. It was a feature in Rolling Stone. And this was like 7 years ago or 8 years ago. And what happened was that right around over Christmas break, a video had popped up online, and it was of... You couldn't see the guy's face, but he's petting these kittens and being all nice to these kittens, and then he suffocates them. And, you know, the quote actually comes from my article. That I wasn't involved with the public. They read my story and then just made a thing on it, which is fine. And it said, the quote comes from my article, which is, rule zero of the internet is don't f*** with cats. So while, you know, over this Christmas break, they're all these little like Facebook groups sprout up. And it's like, we got to catch this guy. We got to figure out who he is. And they start trying to figure out, you know, there was a very distinctive bedspread. Where is that from? A very distinctive, you know, listening to what he was listening to in the background. Where is that from? What country is he from? Because it could be anywhere. There was a vacuum cleaner, which is what he used to suck up the air, to suffocate these cats.
Yeah.
Where is that from? So they start, and you know, this is what happens with a lot of these cases. A lot of people get into it. Some people lose interest after a while, but there are some that kind of broke off and started really digging in and using some very interesting ways of, they thought they found this guy, but you know, this is one of the things that happens with sadistic killers. They have a lot of ego. So they thought it was this one guy, and then this other guy sprouted up in a sock puppet account and said, no, I think it's just the Luca Magnotta guy. So they look at Luca Magnotta. So now they have a name. They start looking at him, and this guy seems like he's everywhere. He's taking pictures of himself in front of sports cars and, you know, overseas. And he's living like this model's life. And he's saying he's a model and everything, but he's trying to be sort of like a celebrity. And there's also a lot of people talking about him too, which we later realized was all these sock puppet accounts that he created. So, you know, in order
to... quickly, what's a sock puppet account?
Like sock puppet account is when you create fake accounts to talk about yourself or something like that. So some people have like 20 accounts that they would be like, you know...
Gotcha.
They would say stuff like, yeah, if that was you, you'd be like, yeah, Chris Jericho was way better than Shawn Michaels. And be like, you know, like, like over and over and over again. And be like, wow, there's a lot of people saying it, but I agree. But yeah, so this guy was doing that. It was like, who the hell's Luca Magnotta? But it's like, oh, there's a guy in California that's talking about Luca Magnotta, that kind of thing. So they're looking at these photos, at trying to see if they could find any clue. And he had posted a picture of himself on a balcony. And I love the way that they did this. And it was like these people that had never met each other working together. And he posted a picture of himself on a balcony, and they could see below the balcony an Esso station. Now, we don't have Esso, we have Exxon in America, but you guys have Esso up in Canada. So they said, and then they remember him talking about, they remember another picture that he took that they had noticed like the way the streetlights were. And they thought, well, I think he's in Toronto. So they went and they looked at for every Esso station through Google Street Maps. And they would walk with Google Street View and look around, get to the Esso station and look around to see if they could see that high rise where he was. And they did it. Like on the seventh one they found, they did it and they found it. They go, they contact the landlord. They had just missed him. But by now they had everything. And as you know, there is what they call a triad for serial killers, particularly for what they do as children. It's wetting the bed, setting fires, and torturing animals. So if you have one, if your kid has one of those three, you know, they say that, you know, just watch them, obviously, and start looking at them. Wetting the bed, obviously, is way more common, but this is considered the serial killer triad. They know that this guy's going to do something. This guy's going to escalate. And what they figure out with him is that, you know, they give an entire dossier and they give it to the police in Toronto and they say, this guy's going to kill somebody. Police do nothing. Constantly, the police do nothing. Police do nothing. Eventually, he posts more videos of him killing animals, but eventually he posts a video in a very similar manner of him with a man, and he's killing the man and dissecting him and cutting him up. That goes up online. Then there's a whole other thing there with trying to find him. He chops the man's body up and sends body parts across Canada to different places, political organizations, and then he skips and he goes to Europe. And then it becomes a manhunt. Then they're like, all right, he killed a person now, just like these animal activists said he was going to. Now it becomes like you actually get Interpol involved. And they find him, much like a serial killer that has a lot of ego, they find him Googling himself in an internet cafe. And it's the way that he, you know, the tenacity of these, that's what I was most interested in, is how these citizen detectives were able to track him down when nobody else was. And the story was laying out like a Coen Brothers movie when they, you know, there's two animal activists that are the Barbie twins that they pose for Playboy. They were really attractive women. They're big animal activists. They got involved and they knew that he wanted to be a porn star, right? So they were going to try and do a sting operation to get him to California. And they enlisted the help of Ron Jeremy. And like, this was like going to be some like sort of weird ramshackle gang that couldn't shoot straight, trying to get this guy that they knew was going to kill a person, trying to get him to California. And then they were going to like have a porn shoot and then grab him, you know? And, you know, they eventually didn't do it. And, you know, Ron Jeremy was, when I interviewed him for that, he was just like, you know, I don't want to, you know, I want my penis to be in the Smithsonian. I don't want to be in a mailed in a, you know, it's like just being the jokester that
right,
he is.
Right.
And, you know, it was just such an odd sort of cast of characters and just showing what the internet could do. And I put that story together and put it out for Rolling Stone. And, you know, they made this documentary about it. And it was just like this kind of stuff, individuals can, they you know, most cops then wouldn't have done that. 99.9% of the cops wouldn't have figured out to look at that photo and then try and, it wasn't even on their radar because everybody was just throwing it over the fence because it wasn't their jurisdiction because they couldn't prove where the crime was happening with the animals. but they were just doing that and doing these people were able to figure it out and get on his tail when the cops wouldn't and probably couldn't.
Well, and the thing is, it's so crazy is you start seeing kind of how he's obsessed with Basic Instinct, the Sharon Stone movie, and then actually orchestrates his interrogation to be just like Sharon Stone's in the movie. That's what started getting chilling for me, that this guy's so crazy. Now he's reenacting his favorite movie while, you know, in jail.
Yeah, and very much the cult of celebrity, trying to be famous. You know, this guy was like trying to be, you know, we always talk about that, like, don't mention the killer's names and these people are trying to be famous. This guy wanted to do that, but he was also incredibly off kilter. And I've heard, like, when he's on his meds, he's fine. But it's just, you know, the guy gets off his meds and he becomes this monster that has two things. You know, he wants to torture people or torture animals. And this animal torture thing, by the way, is a thing that was a cottage industry and still sort of is. People would pay money and watch videos to watch women crushing baby chicks or kittens.
Oh my gosh.
With high heel shoes. Now, they passed a law saying that was illegal. Then they would do this. This is what they would do then. But it was only illegal for vertebrates. So they would post videos of them stepping on jellyfish. But then there would be a link in the YouTube page or whatever to a website that would be behind a paywall, so then people could see them stepping on the animals. You know, it was crazy.
So it's like kind of a fetish type.
It's a fetish, yeah, exactly. And, you know, something that I had never heard from, and opened myself up to this world. It was just like, oh, people really did that. And I was, you know, I come from like a alternative journalism background. I've seen a lot of weird shit, but it's just like that kind of thing was like, wow, I had no idea that was happening.
And so how long did it take to arrest Luca Magnotti, and what's his status right now?
His status, I believe he's guilty. He's in jail. You know, Canada is one of those places. It didn't take that long. It became a manhunt right away. Once he killed the person, you know, he was out with the animal stuff. He had been free for a while, just doing his thing. But once he killed the victim, it was only a matter of weeks before they were able to grab him. Now, what he's doing now is, you know, he's in jail. And, you know, Canada is one of those places that has had in previous times more lenient sentences for crimes like murder. Or if somebody flips on somebody else, you know, before Luca Magnotta, probably the most horrific case in Canada was the Barbie killers with Carla Homolka, who's now out of jail because she flipped on her husband. And, you know, but they would kill, you know, pick up kids on the street and kill them, and then killed her sister by drugging her and everything. And that was like one of the worst crimes ever. And then just, you know.
And why were they called because this one I remember completely. Why were they called the Barbie killers?
Because they were pretty. They looked like Ken and Barbie, you know.
Oh, gotcha.
So it's just like, why, you know, that's what the Canadian press, which is nowhere near as brutal as like the British press, but still they were just like, you know, they're the Barbie killers because, you know, they looked like the all Canadian, I guess, pretty couple, and, you know, had everything going for them, but just, you know, met each other and something just went off with both of them. And then they just did some of the most depraved things you could ever imagine.
So I guess when you are working so much, you know, learning about these serial killers and kind of getting the mindset behind them, like what is the appeal? Is it a power thing? Is it more like a Luca Magnotti thing where it's more about your ego and about being talked about, the celebrity aspect of it?
I think for the serial killers, I mean, power is the main thing more than anything else. It's power, because you have certain serial killers like a BTK, Bind, Torture, Kill, who was in Wichita, or you have Zodiac, or you have Son of Sam. Now, these are guys that were getting off on the power, but their power was, part of it was also with the police, taunting the police, taunting the press, loving being heard about, loving the things that they were writing about be on the front cover of papers. Then there were also people that didn't want to mess with the police. They weren't writing letters. And that's what Golden State Killer was. he was just all about survival. He would call up his victim sometimes. There's a few times that he did that, but he was all about the power of that moment. And probably when, you know, he took souvenirs, he probably relived that moment over and over and over again, but he was not, it was not really with the press. So I think it's all about power. Some of it, though, is going to be about they need a little bit more of that power, so they do the ego thing, which is the taunting the press, or they want to stay sort of, you know, kind of under the radar.
Wow. Once again, there's so much to talk about, but as we kind of start to wind down here, one of your personal questions you mentioned earlier was the Bear Brook murder. I don't know what the status of that is or what the story is. That's another one that I've never really heard of.
Yeah. So in 1985, these two hunters came upon a barrel tipped over on its side. They looked inside, and it turns out that there was human remains in there. It was a woman and a child. They were unidentified, couldn't identify them, didn't know how they got there. 15 years later, they put a new law enforcement on the case. He was just walking around that area, sees another barrel, talking about a 55-gallon drum, and opens it up and finds two more female children's bodies in there, remains. So you have a woman and three children, almost a complete family unit that just disappeared, and nobody was, you know, there was no missing persons reports for them. They didn't know who these people were. They didn't know who killed them. And it remained a mystery for a really, really long time. It turned out the woman was related to two of the children, was the mother of two of the children. And the other one they didn't know about. And it was just a complete mystery. And I went out there in 2016 to tour the scene. And, you know, I really wanted to amplify that case because I just found it horrific. You can listen to on the Murder Squad, we did this case, and you can listen to a podcast called Bear Brook as well. And you read my book. I've got two chapters in it. In a roundabout way, they were able to identify who their killer was before they identified who the victims were. So they knew who the killer was, and it turns out this guy was a serial killer, and he had killed a lot of people throughout time in a very similar manner. And I think he has killed other people as well, and that's one of the things that I'm still working on. But they were able to find out who the killer was. And then, you know, my book comes out, and I've written all about this. I think probably like 3 weeks after my book came out, they were able to identify three of the four victims in the barrels. And that was a citizen that did that. Just a citizen detective. She's a librarian. She was looking, you know, doing searches for this thing, trying to find it, and was able to figure out who this woman was. Her name was Marlise Honeychurch, and two of her children. So we still need to identify the last child that was not related to her. We know it was his daughter, but we don't know who the mother was. So we still don't know where the mother was. We still don't know. There's a few other victims that he had been seen, possible victims that he'd been seen with that were probably murdered by him. This is what this guy would do. And I'm very hesitant when people ask me who the worst serial killer is, but I think this guy's the worst of the worst. And this is why. He would sidle up to a woman with children, single mom. He would separate that woman from her family, you know, her parents or whatever. Mm-hmm. And this is back in the day when it was just phones and mail, and that's it. So people didn't know where those people were, bring them to a new town, molest the children, then kill the mother, use those children as a lure to get the next kind of family.
Oh my God.
And then once those kids were old enough to talk, kill those kids as well and start that cycle again. And we think he did that at least two times. So think about, like, not only is this monster molesting your children and then he kills you, he's using your children as bait to get a whole nother family to kill and then kills your children. I can't think of anything worse than that.
That's terrible. Yeah.
So it turns out this guy's name is Terry Rasmussen. And what I've been trying to do is create a timeline for this guy. We think that I'm working with the detective who put the pieces together. And he's a guy out of San Bernardino.
Jeez.
And this guy was everywhere. This Terry Rasmussen, yeah.
I just saw his mugshot. He looks like the total serial killer.
Yeah, exactly. He's got these like really super clear blue eyes. And he was, you know, the way that they caught him was great. And just, you know, there's video of him being when his jig was up. You know, he was giving false names and they were able to figure out what he did was he would give a false name. They would take his fingerprints, but then they would let him go. He took his fingerprints again. He didn't realize within the time span of the last time that he was arrested and that time when he was under suspicion of a missing woman that they had changed the technology and they could do fingerprints a lot faster. So he thought he'd be gone scot-free the way that he'd always done it. And then they walk into the room and it's like, all right, we know who you are, dude. They actually didn't know who he was. He was still using fake names, but they were able to get him on a warrant, arrest him, and then he was arrested for that murder. He had killed his sort of wife that he married in a ceremony that was a Star Trek ceremony. They weren't really married, but they were married. And then her name was Unsoon June, and then she went missing. And then he actually, turns out he had killed her and buried her under, I think it was 75 pounds of kitty litter.
Oh my gosh, and see, even one of the victims that he killed was identified as his own daughter.
Yeah, that was the one of the girls in the barrel who were still looking for her name. And there's a case in the spring. I went up north to this ditch where a refrigerator was found, and there was a woman found in the refrigerator that I think he probably did kill. There's a lot of, we still need to identify her. I'm still trying to get the DNA and get the police department to actually do it. And I say, I'll pay for the DNA test. Like, just let me do it. And this woman was very similar circumstances, blunt force trauma, tied up with you know, electrical stuff. And he was an electrician and there was electric things in the barrels with the other women. And she was put in a refrigerator. So a man-made object and then tossed. All the earmarks to the way that this guy acted. And there was also a lot of clues within the refrigerator itself that would lead to areas where this guy was.
I mean, that's just pure evil. You know, I mean, there's no other explanation as to how somebody could turn out that way.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's just, I don't, you know, I mean, it's just like, and this was, you know, when we're talking about the what drives them, this was a power thing, pedophilia and power, getting what you want, narcissism, all of that.
Does it ever kind of bum you out sometimes when you're kind of, this is your job, is to talk about this and find these guys and kind of obsess on their details?
You know what? It doesn't really bum me out, but you definitely need to get away a little bit. And I get away,
yeah.
You know, because I know that the victims' families are there. So I do... You know, I'm a bit of a nerd and I like, you know, going to Disneyland or like Harry Potter world. You know, I watch WWE. I watch, you know, a bunch of, you know, just different sort of goofy things. I'm like binging The Office for the fifth time, you know, under quarantine, you know. But, you know, I think it's you gotta give yourself those outlets, you know. And it was great to just to see, you know, the creativity that had happened around. Yeah, that's one of the things I'm learning about in this lockdown is like the creativity that it's forcing you to do, be more creative things. You know, it's like,
absolutely.
You know, I know a lot of your listeners are wrestling fans. Like that graveyard match was so great and so creative. They probably wouldn't have done that if it was regular WrestleMania, you know?
No, you wouldn't. There would be no need to. We just did one in AEW, the Stadium Stampede match. Had there been no virus, there wouldn't have been no need for that, like you said.
Yeah, and so it's like forcing people to do certain things, and it stinks, and it's just like, you know, the idea of like, you know, at first it was weird like watching without a crowd, but I love like how Mick Foley was like tweeting out like, can I please be in the next graveyard match, you know?
Well, let's talk about that briefly. You said that you were at the first WrestleMania.
I was at the, well, even before that, I was there when Hogan won the belt, so
oh
that was
gosh.
Huge. Yeah, oh man. That was a powerful 6 minutes right there. And and then I was there when Hogan won the belt. And then I was at the first WrestleMania. I was there. I was probably my most proudest moment in wrestling was I am on Saturday night's main event when it was at Nassau Coliseum. Because I was, yeah. And there's a picture of this video of me giving the finger. And I know why I was giving the finger, because I was giving the finger at Roddy Piper, who I hated at the time and since has become my favorite wrestler because of how he was able to get that reaction out of me. He was just such an amazing heel and really just was like such a great troll. And it was like he was saying something bad about the New York Islanders, you know, and I was like, give it. And I was like giving him the arm. My dad's like just smiling next to me. And but the way that they cut it, I'm giving the finger when they mention Cindy Lauper.
So it's like, so you're, and then you see me in the background, because they didn't, obviously the sensors didn't catch it, but I'm in the background. I'm like, oh my God, that's me. And I'm like giving the finger. So I found that on video, like through the WWE Network, and I was able to find it. I was like, oh my God, there it is. And I would just, you know, it was one of those things where I started out in professional writing. I started out in sports, but I started out writing about hockey fights. I was a hockey player, and, right. and I would wrote about hockey fights, and I would write about them in the same way that you would write about a boxing match, like who won, who lost, how it affected the game. Village Voice saw that and gave me like, hey, you want to write about like one thing, one article? And then I just kept on writing. And then I started pitching more stuff. And then I think the first wrestling thing, I think I pitched a story about Mick Foley I interviewed Mick because he's from Long Island. And I just thought he was just a really interesting character. I think this was when he was Mankind. And then, just doing different things here and there around the you know, just trying to do. I just always was a big fan of wrestling. And I remember just like, you know, going to Nassau Coliseum with my dad and watching, you know, Tony Atlas and Rocky Johnson and those guys. And man, it's just it's a great escape. And it's a great escape now, you know. And then the era that you were in and the whole Attitude Era. It's funny too, because like I left wrestling probably like at like 13, and then I got back into it at like 25, you know. And then right. you know, it's like when the Attitude Era happened, and I was like, it was like right before I think my wife was pregnant, and it's like I had no money, and I was just like, just started watching this. I was like, oh, watch what's going on with wrestling. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. You know, just with the Monday Night Wars and everything. And I was like, this is great. Sure. So then I started going back again. And just, I loved so much of what they were doing during that Attitude Era. And then obviously you get, you know, it's just like some people are like, you know, and then I would get back into it again and then just like see like, wow, that's really good. And just the stuff that's happening with the women's division, I think is just great. And the NXT and things. So I just, no, I really dig it. So yeah, this is very cool to be able to talk to you.
Well, cool, man, and vice versa to you. And just one last thing, I didn't even know about the documentary for I'll Be Gone in the Dark and the whole Michelle McNamara story. So that's kind of her life's work documented in this series. I'm sure you're probably pretty proud of that.
Yeah, it's her life's work in parallel with her trying to catch this guy. So it's telling the story about Golden State Killer. And her story as well. And then when she passes and then us picking it up and things. So, yeah, it's a 6-part series and it starts on June 28th. It's HBO, so you can't binge it. You just got to come back every week and watch it.
Wow, what? What are you talking about?
I know,
about?
Sorry.
I can't do that. Well, Billy, it's been a blast talking to you, man. Like I said, there's so many other topics we can discuss. And I mean, like, there's some crazy people in the world, but you're doing everything you can to bring them in. So much respect on that. And I'm sure we'll be talking again soon.
Absolutely. I'd love to be on anytime. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it.